the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. As of this recording, which when you hear it will have been a week ago, my cat is still is doing amazingly well. I'll let you know next week when we're back on schedule and Brendan's back from vacation. But that aside, we're coming up on our 1,000th episode, okay? 1,000 episodes of this show. And I like to read emails on the air occasionally, so I want to hear any questions you might have as we approach that milestone show, 1,000. You can send your questions to WTFpod@gmail.com. Any questions about any of the 1,000 episodes of the show or any past guests that you want some follow-up on, any questions you have for me personally, if they're nice, or yeah, you can be challenging, just don't be a fucking asshole. Questions about what goes on off the mic are fine, and behind the scenes, you can, some of that. Or any advice you think I might be able to dispense, I'm willing to give it a shot. Send those to me at WTFpod@gmail.com. If you can get us to questions by the end of the month, that would be helpful. Also, John Bernthal is on the show today. John Bernthal is an actor. You probably know him from The Walking Dead, the first season or two of The Walking Dead. He's now in the third season of The Punisher, which is available on Netflix. You can stream all three seasons right now. He is The Punisher. He was in The Wolf of Wall Street. You'll recognize him when you look him up or you've seen him. He's an intense fellow. He usually plays an angry dude of some sort. Oh, he's in the first Sicario movie, too. I like him. I like him. He's all in. And it was exciting to get to talk to him, so you'll get to hear that. Pretty unique story, really, in terms of life and acting. It involves Russia. That's what I'm saying. There was collusion between John Bernthal and Russia. But I would like to add this, that I am recording this a week out, because, as you know, if you listen to this show regularly, my business partner and producer, Brendan, is on vacation with his wife. So we did these shows last week. So I'm wary to sort of go into any immediate stories that are happening today, because they're a week old, and who the fuck knows what could happen in a week, right? Not just with me, with you, with the world, with this country. And who knows? So I can't really do a show like that where I'm engaged in. Well, I'm immediately engaged what I'm talking to you about right now, but it is a week ago. Does that make any sense? I would like to get back to it. I got a couple things that happened. If some of you were listening, a while back I got an email from this guy, Jacob, and he basically was talking about me doing, he saw me in Bloomington at this small club up there, a great club called the Comedy Attic. And he said, I saw you in Bloomington last year working out your new stuff. And at one point, you got up from the stool, walked to the side of the stage, looked at me and said, "How's it going?" In that moment, I thought you were asking how I was doing, so I said something along the lines of, "Good." You said, "Okay," went back to the stool, and continued on with the show. Now, I also told you after that, if I said that, if my recollection was correct, I would not have done that unless I thought this dude was threatening somehow. If I had projected some sort of threat, that I saw him as somebody, he was probably alone. Maybe he, I thought he was going to kick my ass, or he gave me stink eye. I don't know what it was. But I knew that if I was doing that, there's only one reason I do that, is to disarm a potential situation that I'm making up in my head. And he wrote me back after I said that. I told you guys that, what I thought it was. He said, "Hey, Mark, my bet is on. I was a scary looking dude. I've got long hair and a long beard, and something about the way my face is, I just look angry a lot of the time. I get a lot of questions like, what's wrong? Or what are you thinking? Which is what I did from stage, when nothing is wrong and I'm not really thinking anything. I stuck around after the show, and I got to tell you that I loved Attempting Normal, especially the Lou Reed guitar pick story. And I got a quick picture of you and attached it. And yeah, even smiling in that picture, I look a little scary or angry." Now, I wish you could see this picture, because this guy, he's a big boy. He's got long hair, a beard, looks like he could just break me like a fucking stick, like a twig, just twist me up like a pretzel, just like crush me in his hand. So I guess I'm just tooting my own horn that I knew exactly why I asked a guy in the audience, "How you doing?" Because he looked like he could do some harm Turns out, not a bad guy, apparently. Not a bad guy. Weird. Another thing happened today that I think is sort of an evergreenish kind of thing. It's not time relative. I got a call on my cell phone. I was in my car. I didn't recognize the number, but I'm an idiot. I know what spam numbers look like, but this looked like it was local, so I picked it up. It was just some guy going, "Hey, is this Mark Maron?" And I'm like, "Who's this? Is this Mark Maron? Well, if this is Mark Maron, I'm so and so. He's from a talent agency, a big one. His name was Pete." And I'm like, "What's this about?" He's like, "I just saw you. I was at the art show at the Freeze. My Sarah the painter had an installation over at Freeze LA in the back lot at Paramount, which is where they had the fair. It was pretty amazing." And I'm like, and I was on the other line with Brendan. I'm like, "Hold on a minute." And I got back on. I'm like, "Now, what is this? Who is this?" He goes, "My name's Pete so-and-so from this agency, that agency." He says, "I got to tell you a story, man." Now, I'm going to preface this by saying, rarely in my life has my being an asshole necessarily done anybody any real good, myself included. But this guy out of nowhere says, "Look, man, is this you? Is this your number?" I'm like, "Just what?" "So you got 30 seconds?" I'm like, "Come on." "Yes." He goes, "All right." I just figured he was legit on some level. I mean, it wasn't great that he was calling me, but he was doing. He says, "Look, man, back in, I went to Emerson College. It was like before school even started. I had a crush on this girl, or I just saw this girl and I really liked her. And we ended up having lunch one day." I'm paraphrasing his story. "And she decided I wasn't scary, that we could hang out one night. We went to Harvard Square. I was like 17 or 18 years old." The guy's 45 now. So what is that? 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago. "We're walking around Harvard Square. The doorman at Catch a Rising Star says, 'You want to go to a comedy show?' I didn't know if I was old enough or whatever, but we got in. They walked us in." This is the first night he's with this girl. He says he walked in. They seat him right up front. And he says he's with this girl he doesn't really know. It's like a first date. So the doorman probably thought he was doing him a favor. He said, "The first guy on stage was me. And I did about 5 minutes of material, then I just opened up on him. And I just fucking ripped into him for 15 minutes. He said it was devastating. Just leveled him. Just like, and at that point, like, what was that? Like 20, that long ago, I must have been just a bully. I probably for no reason just eviscerated this guy. Is that the word? But apparently after the show, this woman, who this was their first date, said, "You didn't cry. You didn't fall apart. You didn't come unhinged. You didn't." And she said, "I'm going to marry you someday." And now they've been married for like over 25 years. And he just wanted to call me because it reminded him, I guess, to thank me. I said, "How'd you get my number?" He says, "I'm a crazy agent guy. I've got everyone's number." But that was nice, I guess. It was a little weird. A little without boundary, but it's rare that, you're a complete dick and it brings people together, and that's a lasting bond. I'm sure I didn't have anything to do with the thing lasting, but anyway, that was that story and that was that email. All right, so John Bernthal, I always liked him on screen. I always liked John Bernthal on screen, and I was happy to talk to him. He seemed intense. I was wondering, what was in there? What's in that guy? Huh? He's in The Punisher. He is The Punisher. The third season of The Punisher is now available on Netflix. And you can stream all the seasons right now. And this is me talking to the nicer than you think, John Bernthal. So, Ojai, when did you move up there? How long you lived up there?
You know, I moved up there. We've been there about 5 years. I did a movie. I did this movie, Sicario, just a small part with and Emily Blunt was in it.
Yeah, you were a morally bankrupt fucker.
It's kind of my thing, man. Yeah, it's kind of my MO. But she lived up there, and, you know, we I'd been in Venice for... years, you know, since about 2003.
Really?
That's... Yeah. And you know, I had three kids at this point and really sort of wanted a big life change. And I was talking to Emily about it. And yeah. She said, you know, make the move to Ojai. It's incredible. We went up there and I saw a house. I fell in love with it. And that was kind of it. And then the second I moved up there, she moved out.
Oh, really? Just Emily like, left?
Shit, yeah. It wasn't that serious. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, man. So you drove down here today?
I drove in last night. Oh. I actually, saw some friends last night, which is something I never
do. Yeah,
you had
a good excuse.
Some old friends. Yeah, it was great. It was great. I went to a really cool bar at Union Station called the Streamliner.
Oh yeah,
like completely untouched from back in the day.
Oh really?
It was really cool.
One of those old timey drinking bars.
Yeah, yeah. I don't drink, man, but it was cool to sort of be there. And then when everybody gets drunk, I take off.
You never drink?
I definitely did. Yeah, I definitely did, but no longer.
Really?
No longer. Yeah.
You got sober.
Yeah. In some ways, I mean, I still will smoke a little marijuana from time to time. You know what I mean? Sometimes.
Right. Oh, so it's not like you're not like, because I have been sober a long time.
I know,
but you're not like no nothing.
It was really for me a big kind of life change that kind of all happened at once The drinking wasn't necessarily my problem, but it was the things that would happen when I drank.
Oh, yeah,
I guess that's the same for fucking everybody.
Right,
but I really needed to cut the other shit out, so you know, drinking helped with that.
Sure, you know? Right? Yeah. You just lose a few days.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I mean, it was a good, you know, it was right around 2009, it was July 3rd, 2009, you know, I'd gotten in a bunch of trouble sort of growing up, kind of different episodes of some, you know, street violence, you know, and there was one more thing, and it happened at a time in my life where it just had no excuse to happen.
You're too old for that shit?
And way too old, man. And it was weird that it was kind of like an acute sort of thing, and this one event happened, and that was kind of it. I had a real honest conversation with myself, and
it
was just done.
Well, because you probably realize, like, the thing I always realize is that when you're doing shit, you sort of, your odds of getting... you know, fucking dying one way or the other, or getting into trouble that you can't get out of, is exponentially much higher.
100%. And especially when you've been in trouble and when you've been in that situation and you've lost friends and you've seen all this shit and you just keep on pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And then sometimes it's something that maybe compared to other shit you've done is quite benign.
Right.
But this one thing for this one reason, it's all about fucking timing.
And
that's
then,
you know, something happens and you stare yourself in the face and you talk to somebody else and you're just like, hey man, you get me out of this one. I'm fucking done. And that's what happened to me. And really everything in my life
changed, shifted
after that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many of those you get. Me out of this one, right? But
such a blessing if you get it and you're aware of it,
know,
and you actually do something about it. You know what I mean?
Well, wait. So you were some sort of fuck up kid?
Look, man.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in D.C., in Washington, D.C. Do you know D.C.?
A little.
Yeah.
I mean, I know. I've been to the city a few times. I've been to Alexandria a few times. I wouldn't know it to sort of like, if you were to start naming neighborhoods, I wouldn't know it.
Right.
But it wasn't like you grew up, in the bad side of town or anything.
No, I mean, D.C. was a crazy place, man. I absolutely didn't. You know, I came from a really, really good home. A lot of support. Great parents, great brothers. My parents were also foster parents. So they brought in kids.
Really?
And,
So your dad, like, what was the family business?
So my old man was a lawyer, but he built himself up. He sort of, guy from Syracuse. He's sort of a blue collar guy. And then he became a lawyer and became more and more and more and more successful as we got older, which was kind of a crazy thing to see. And
his own firm or?
No, nothing like that. But he became, it's funny because he was one of those self-hating lawyers, you know, he deep down, he came from a very different world. And I think growing up, he sort of looked at, you know, lawyers with their fancy cars and their fancy houses and all this bullshit. And, you know, nobody hated a lawyer more than him. And slowly but surely, you know, he kind of became exactly that as we got older.
Slippery slope.
Yeah, man.
But, it starts to look good and feel good, you know?
That's right. That's right. And you know, he ended up giving it all up. And, you know, he retired and dedicated his life to the Humane Society. Then he was the chairman of the board of the Humane Society.
Animal guy.
It's a big time. It loves animals way more than people, man. Yeah.
So his family, and does your mom work?
My mom was worked with troubled teens, clinical psychoanalyst, social worker, all that. Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Social work, it fascinates me. I don't think they get enough credit.
I totally agree, man.
You know what I mean?
It's like, and I think D.C. at the time, you know, when you look at D.C. in the 80s and the 90s, it was, an extremely rough city and a fascinating city.
Yeah.
A conglomeration of all these different kinds of people coming together. I found that, very small city too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We're all kind of on top of each other. And if you're sort of an adventure, it doesn't really matter what part of D.C. you grow up in. If you have a sort of a knack for adventure and you want to get into shit, it's all right there.
But you were the one in your family. I mean, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have two blood brothers and they're both enormously successful guys. I got a little brother who's a orthopedic oncologist, surgeon at UCLA, like Princeton basketball player.
You guys get along?
They're my best friends in the world.
And what's the other brother do?
Super successful businessman. Journalism. He was a producer for NBC, won a bunch of Emmys and left and started a market research company.
We're here in New York or here?
All here. We all lived in Venice. Then my four best friends from D.C., we all moved out to
Venice.
What
about your folks?
They are back in D.C., but they come out a lot.
So they're originally from upstate New York, your old man?
My old man, yeah.
From working class Jews?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
From the peasant stock?
That's exactly right.
Alpha Jew?
Big time, brother. Big time. Big time. Big time.
Yeah. Mobsters and plumbers.
That's exactly, you fucking hit it on the head. That's enough. That's all I'm going to say about that, but you hit it, brother.
Yeah. So what about your mom? Is it that same thing?
Kind of. You know, my mom's family is interesting. They're, you know, Texas and Missouri. And,
Jews?
And yeah, man. And like really, you know.
I love that, man.
Farmers and soldiers and, you know.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, man. So, and it's funny because it's like the idea, you know, where I grew up and how I grew up, there weren't, Jewish culture. It was just, to me, it seemed much more of a New York thing, you know, in D.C.
Yeah, and upper class, too. Like, there's that moment where you realize, you know, as a Jew, that, you know, the generations had to come up to that.
Big time.
And there's all these, you know, just, I remember I worked at a Jewish deli outside of Boston when I was in college, just an old Jewish deli. And these guys, cops would come in, Jewish cops. And this, like, there was a whole generation before our parents' generation that really scrapped. You know, there were a bunch of Jewish boxers.
Yeah, my dad's uncle was Golden Gloves champion in New York. You know, they every day walking to school, they had to fight the Italian kids. And those are the stories that I grew up in, you know. You know, they were, you know, I'd cut cousins who were robbing banks, you know, the whole thing, man, you know, and it was a very different.
It's a sobering thing as a Jew to realize that, it makes you feel good. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're not all rich assholes.
That's right, brother. That's right. That's right.
I talked to Tim Blake Nelson. He's an Oklahoma Jew.
Oh, wow, I didn't know.
I know,
wow,
man.
Wow.
Like
his
parents, you know, got out under the Nazi thing and they were relocated by that agency. It's an old organization that was designed to get Jews out of the pogroms and integrated into the states, but they spread everybody out,
right,
because they knew that they were going to come to get us at some point,
right.
So if we could relocate everybody in different parts,
they'd have
less of a shot at getting all of us,
right.
So his
right.
family ended up in Oklahoma City, and they became oil Jews.
Wow,
he was a wildcatter. His maternal grandfather was out drilling oil wells, and then became a huge oil guy.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Missouri and Texas Jews. I know Texas Jews.
Do you?
El Paso, Houston. El Paso had a big Jewish community. I grew up in New Mexico.
Right. No, I know that.
So you do? Did you do some research?
No, man. I'm a huge fan of your show. I love your show, man. And it's funny because Tim, he's the next one.
You hadn't listened to it yet?
I skipped over that and listened to Maggie, you know, and I love that. I love that interview.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing about Tim, I didn't know anything because you just make assumptions about people.
100%.
And then I like did a little research and I'm like, what the fuck?
And he's
you know, a very eloquent, kind of mild-mannered Jewish guy from Oklahoma.
Does he have an accent in real life?
A little bit.
Yeah.
He sort of does.
Wow.
So, all right, so you're growing up the black sheep, the troublemaker, and the lawyer's kid who's got problems. Mm. Is that you?
I'd say that's fair, man. I'd say that's fair. I think, you know, I really had... And I think what it comes down to is all kinds of deep, deep fears and shit like that and all kinds of, you know, confusion. But, you know, I really was sort of fascinated at a young age with violence. And I was in this really, really ultra violent city. And I was in ways protected by it, in ways when I think of now my own kids living in a teeny town like Ojai, and I look at the way I grew up, you know, I mean, it didn't seem scary or anything to me at the time, but, you know, I started getting mugged, you know, when I was probably 10, you know what I mean? And, you know, taking the subway and the bus to school, you know, just shit that kids don't really do anymore. And, you know, I was always sort of attracted and wanted to be best friends with the kids that, you know, at first it was the kid that carried the switchblade, then it was the kid that was dealing crack, then it was the kids who carried guns. And I always, that was sort of my thing. And I had this core of best friends that are still my best friends who, you know, are all, you know, successful guys in their own right and really got out of that. But we just had a fucking nose for trouble, man. And it was just, we loved each other and we got each other's back. And I think for young men, it's a strange thing because we grew up at this time where our way of telling each other we loved each other and kind of making love to each other, for lack of a better word, was to sort of engage in these kinds of street fights with people and to stand up to anybody who wanted to and get each other's backs.
Right.
And
create the bond of loyalty.
This shit, man. And it stayed with us way too fucking long in this
totally. Like, wait, like, but we weren't like, it wasn't like you were in public school, were you?
No, but we were, I mean, DC's a strange place because you have conglomeration of kids. I mean, the school that I went to, you know, now strangely is where the Obama daughters ended up. It's called Sidwell, and it was a Quaker school, which was fucking nuts.
But that's one of those like aristocratic prep schools, right?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, the way that the school worked when I was going is that 30% of the kids would pay for the other 70% to go.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't really a prep school.
It was, but it was, you know, really some of the main tenets of Quakerism, which I find fascinating, are diversity, and it wasn't just racially diverse or socioeconomically diverse. But, you know, there's a huge pressure to be for behavioral diversity, and kids who got kicked out of public schools could come to this school. And there's this whole idea there that, you know, within this sort of utopian community, these kids who were dealing with real shit outside of the school, everything, you know, you were supported there, and it was all about conflict resolution, and it was this place where everybody could come together and feel, you know, loved. And what you had is on campus, these kids who were engaging in real shit outside of school were really kind of proud and happy to be there. And interestingly, you know, what happened to that school, you know, when Bill Clinton won the election, you know, he brought Chelsea to D.C.
Yeah.
And it was this thing where, you know, the D.C. public school system at that time was just a fucking, I mean, it was, you know, the Secret Service looked at what those schools were like. And they said, we cannot send Chelsea to any of these schools.
How can we secure this child?
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, they took a look, and, you know, Clinton had done so much for the public school system in Little Rock, and they look politically, you know, where do we send her? Because if we send her to one of these sort of hoity-toity private schools, it's not going to look good. And they looked at our school and they said, wow, it's so diverse and they got all kinds of kids, let's send them there. And then the Secret Service took a closer look and they looked at some of these kids and they had legitimate criminal records and shit like that.
Yeah.
And what was crazy is that in the 150-year history of the school, there had never been an expulsion, ever. All disciplinary measures were student-run, and, you know, it was really a community of support. And what happened was when the national media spotlight was sort of focused on this school, in a two-year period, they kicked out, like, half the African-American males. They brought in a new administration. They just started kicking these kids out left and right. And it was this crazy fucking... This crazy contradiction, this crazy, you know, is everything that we had been inundated with.
What was it, a business move?
I don't know. I mean, I think really what it was PR, you know, and like all of a sudden, you know, now that you have the president's kid there, you know, all of a sudden we'll get a different, you know, you'll have more kids maybe paying full freight.
Right,
and
right.
And I'm not exactly sure what it was, but I know that right before our eyes, I think, you know.
You were there?
High school, I was there, man. And I think that, you know, high school is always a sort of coming of age time, and you start to see a lot about how the real world works. And
in
DC, you see a lot when you're really young, but the absolute hypocrisy and sort of institutionalized racism that took place from this institution that we totally believed in and totally preached. I mean, we sang the Black National Anthem in that school. We you know, we were absolutely inundated.
And the kids believed in it.
Big time, man.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is the one sort of bit of the institution that they couldn't touch is, I don't know if you know anything about Quakerism, but one of the things I really dig about it is, you know, there's no hierarchy in that religion, right?
Right.
So there's no priest, there's no, so the way you pray is you all sit in silence, and if that of God moves any of you, anybody can get up and address the congregation at any time.
I didn't know that.
So there's no, you know, there's no leaders, no followers.
Right.
So once a week for sort of my entire upbringing, the entire school body, buildings and grounds, security, coaches, teachers, students, all sat in silence. And if anybody was moved, they would go and they could address the entire community.
Did you preach at times?
I preached once.
Yeah.
I got up once, man. I got up once.
Because you felt God?
You know, the time that I don't think I've ever fucking talked about, the time that I got up was, you know, I was sort of in and out of trouble with the law a bunch, even in
for
high
what?
School. A lot of fighting and bullshit and always in trouble with the school, always, you know, about to get kicked out.
Usually,
you
know, fighting?
A lot of that.
Shoplifting?
And, when I was younger, that was sort of
car
a younger
theft.
Thing. Never stole a car. No,
okay.
Yeah, no, we took the all subway, right. Man. Just, you don't want to fuck around with the car. But, I remember there was a guy, I was out in Maryland, and, you know, D.C. is interesting because you have these pockets of Maryland and Virginia right there, and you can be in D.C., and then all of a sudden you can be in this little spot in Maryland or Virginia, and it's like, all of a sudden you're in the deep South, you know,
right.
it's so crazy where that is. And we were in a spot like that, and I remember a man was there and started going after, that we were playing basketball, and went after one of my friend's little brothers, and, grabbed him and threw him on the ground, and we tried to get him off, and he ran away. And I remember I went and to a payphone and I called the police, and I was so ashamed that I that I snitched on this guy. And like, this is how fucking crazy
the outlaw
my head is.
Code.
You know what I mean? And that's what I got up and talked about. I mean, yeah, it's fucking embarrassing. I just admitted that. But
it's a weird. It's a, you know, the loyalty among thieves.
I guess so, man. I guess so.
No, but I mean, not even thieves. But no, I understand the predicament.
Yeah, you know, man. There
was part of you that thought, you know, we should have handled this.
I guess so. I guess so. And think about the.
If you had beat the shit out of him, would you have felt better?
I don't think I would have got up in meeting
the
for
cops.
Worship. Yeah, you know what I mean. I don't think so. But I just look. I'm extremely grateful for how I grew up, and I think that the challenge now is, you know, I think in you know, being an artist, I think that by itself saved my life, changed the course of
sure,
my life.
Sure, but let me ask you something though about the impulse.
Mm-hmm.
When you guys were together, when you guys were, you know, fighting other dudes, I mean, was it, you know, do you see yourself as somebody who was a bully or just somebody who was fighting like-minded people?
We were, that was the thing with us, you know, we were the guys that, we were the underdogs. We were the laughing stock. We were the guys who our football team had never won a homecoming game in 100 years.
You were on the football team?
I was. And I grew up with these guys. And our team was...
It's rare that a football player is the underdog in high school.
Well, but compared to the other schools.
Because they were smart.
Know,
oh, just in
right,
okay.
Compared to the other school. And that, it was never within our school. It was always other schools.
Oh, okay.
And they would all... you know, we were never... You know, my best friend growing up, Greg Zumis, you know, he grew up, his mom's a brilliant writer, you know, would write for the New Yorker, and his sister's a great writer. And, you know, he grew up in this like unbelievably sort of progressive feminist home. And, you know, his mother's a Buddhist, and he was this guy, he never cursed, but like literally one of the most legendary street fighters in the history of DC. And he was one of these guys that never raised his voice, you know, but when, it was this thing like, hey, if you guys want to do this, well, but we were never the guys that look for it.
Right.
Never. We were just always willing participants.
But it's funny because it seems like you had a relatively thoughtful, progressive, like, moral Jewish upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he did too. Like, I guess there's a sort of, like, if you've got it in you to push back on that. I mean, like, I guess I did it, but not in the fighting way. But, you know, for me, like, I liked gravitating to charismatic fuckheads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my dad was kind of a charismatic fuckhead.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was, I was never a fighter. But you do want, you know, there's room in the progressive sort of upbringing where you're sort of like, well, I'm gonna push the envelope this way.
That's it.
You have the freedom to do that because you're not being disciplined like, you know, regular fucking parents.
That's it. And look, man, to rebel is to rebel. And I think, like, you know, violence is some sort of disruption. You want to disrupt, you want to disturb, and that can be something that you're doing to yourself. It can be something, you know, that you're willing to participate in when it's with someone else.
But you had this, I mean, you must have at some point, I mean, what were your parents' reactions to this? You have some other thing in you. I mean, you have whatever they, you know, whatever makes your brother an orthopedic surgeon, you have that as well. So how are they reacting to all this shit?
You know, I my brothers have said it before. I can, you know, especially as a parent now, I cannot believe the patience that they fucking had with me. I mean, you know, there were times literally, you know, where I remember my mother, you know, my poor mom, my mother having to, you know, looking down the block, looking at what cars are coming down, seeing if it was policemen coming, you know, telling me to hide behind the kitchen counter. You know,
really?
Yeah, man. But I remember, like, you know,
that's very progressive.
But here's the thing.
Get down, kid.
You know what I mean? But the thing is that, you know, like, it really was. They really always did see something in me. I always felt loved by them. I always felt supported by them. And you know, when I said to them, I mean, it's also just sort of a good life lesson of setting the bar really fucking low, because, you know, I think a lot of kids who may have grown up the way I did, if they said, hey, I want to be an artist, I want to be an actor, their parents would say, I fucking paid for this education. There's no way you're doing that.
But also,
my folks were like, great.
You're he
wants to do something.
He's not going to end up in jail.
That's it.
I guess that's really the fear, is that, you know, you've got this kid that is this way. You know, how do we stop him from doing himself in for life? So what was the white light moment that enabled you to find this other way?
I think it all started for me. You know, my mother had done a little bit of acting in college, and, you know, she always told me, You're an actor. She always told me that you could do it.
You got to be a pretty good bullshit artist to be a criminal in a progressive Jewish house. You got to sell some line of bullshit to your parents.
Right. But you know, man, I went to a small liberal arts college in upstate New York.
And, which one?
It's called Skidmore.
I know that one. It's a good school, right?
Yeah, pretty good. I got it. I played baseball. That's how I got in. I ended up taking an acting class. There was a woman there named Alma Becker.
So you were the jock in the acting class?
Yeah, man. And I took the class totally...
just because it would be easy.
Just get rid of a fucking requirement. Me being the asshole I was, I thought I was taking a class. It was going to be 300 people watching movies, you know, I ended up with 10 theater majors. I signed up for the wrong fucking thing, you know what I mean?
So you were kind of a dick.
Total idiot. But I ended up in this class, you know, the Alma saw something in me. She really saved my life, man. She put me in my first play. She was the one when I couldn't finish school. I had gotten into some trouble. I couldn't finish
what
school.
What trouble there?
I had gotten in trouble back before I'd gone to college, and was sort of hanging over me the whole time I was there.
You got busted?
There was a fight. Yeah, a fight before I went to school.
Hanging over you?
Hanging over me. And then
You mean you had to do time, or you're on probation, or what?
Probation, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so I went to Alma and I said, hey, look, I really want to do this. I really want to be an actor. And she arranged for me to move to Russia and audition for the Moscow Art Theater. I ended up that event and almost seeing that in me, yeah, really changed everything.
So when we took the class, it was just a year with her for initially?
It was a year with her initially.
And what were you learning? So you're this guy, you've got this attitude, and you know, you get to this class, and then, you know, what do you see that makes you realize that, you know, like, I can do this? I mean,
I think that there was an energy that an energy of adventure and an energy of abandonment.
Oh, that didn't require beating people up. Like, you could get up there and pretend, and, you know, it's all very immediate.
Go fucking nuts, man. You could dive into this, and it was just as chaotic, just as dangerous as anything I had ever done, except now people were supporting me.
There's a context
saying,
that is not some sort of outlaw code.
And that's it. And
right.
and it was just as dangerous. It was just as exciting.
Because he was terrifying to go up there and to be open or to try to do
absolutely,
things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to get up in front of an audience. And you know, I think it's something, I mean, to this day when I think about, you know, stand up, you know, one of my best friends is a guy who I grew up boxing with. He's a stand-up comedian named Sean Kerrigan and undefeated pro fighter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really looked at the link between being a boxer and being a comedian. And it's one of the things, just to go up there and that risk that you take and the danger and that anything can fucking happen. You can fucking get killed up there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's such a, I'm so envious of it.
Or you can just die.
Yeah, right. Or it can just be fucking lame, right? I just think any high-stakes situation, it was something that I got a huge rush off of, and then I realized, wow, for the first time in my life, adults and peers are looking at me and saying, hey, you're pretty good at this. You're not like a total fuck up.
And you're doing something, you know, creative, and depending on what you're doing, there's meaning and lessons in it.
I think that's right. Right. I think that's
but
right.
Yeah, but I know the juice you feel when you first get up there, where like it's usually about like, am I going to look like an asshole?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, am
mm-hmm.
I going to make a fool out of myself?
Mm-hmm.
And you do,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then you start to integrate that. Because I think, I imagine with somebody like you, I'm not a psychoanalyst, that mm-hmm. the fear of looking, of embarrassment had to be a big thing.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I'll be honest with you. I was always kind of an outsider in that theater. I mean, I was the guy showing up, you know, in a baseball uniform or, you know, going to practice right after. You
scaring
know.
scaring the fragile people.
But see, it was really the other way. They scared me, man. And
well, I know,
think
but
that's
they,
the coolest part of it.
Did
you know?
They know that?
I don't know. I think that.
This is like an after school movie.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, you know, I just, that theater specifically in that theater department
at Skidmore.
At Skidmore was really sort of steeped in the avant-garde theater scene. The head of the department was this guy Gautam Dasgupta, who was a huge dramaturg in the 60s and in the avant-garde theater. So
Julian Beck, Living Theater, Theater
big time,
of Cruelty,
Richard Foreman.
Foreman.
So like I basically had these two things kind of pulling at me. I had Alma, who was this teacher. I mean, once I got the bug, that was it, man. I was in a play every second from then on.
What was the
I quit
first
the baseball
play?
Team. The Scarlet Letter. I played Chillingworth.
Yeah.
And,
so you quit the team?
Quit the team. I got involved with this theater company. We all lived in a house together, and the theater company would
in
do
Skidmore?
Shows. In Saratoga.
Yeah.
We performed at this place called Cafe Lena, which was this little coffee shop in Saratoga Springs where, you know, Bob Dylan started. It was just beautiful. And we did these crazy fucking shows. And then Richard Foreman saw our stuff and he had us do shows at the Ontological in New York. So I would be in school and driving down to New York doing plays there. And then we would start doing plays in D.C. as well. So I would be in the school play. I'd be in the
just you or the troupe?
The whole group.
So you did some Foreman stuff?
Yeah, we did Foreman stuff.
There's always a lot going on stage
big time,
with Foreman.
Yeah,
it's like a lot of people, a lot going on.
Yeah, yeah, you know, anything. Masks, yeah. Noises, you know what I mean? All
crazy.
Kinds of shit.
I saw one Foreman show and I was like, what the fuck?
It was like
you, your brain's trying to get, you know, figure out what it's about, and then you realize like, nah, don't, you know, just take it in.
Yeah,
you know, let it happen.
Just be there, man. Just be there. He's there controlling the lights like a puppet master.
It's
crazy. It's great, man. It's great. But I really dug that in it, and I think that, you know, I'm enormously grateful to the time in Russia. And I think that's where.
Well, how does that happen? So like, yeah. So Alma Becker,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and what, you know, what acting tools or what were you learning? What was the approach to the craft with her?
With
initially,
her, you know, she was. I think more than anything else, when I think about Alma, there was a vitality to it. It was vital. It was unbelievably and deeply important. And I mean, look, the way that it kind of literally sparked for me.
Yeah.
And I hate fucking. I feel like such a douchebag repeating myself because I've told this story before, but I'm told
right.
it to you. So, the way that it kind of all started is one of the first. exercises that we had to do in that class before I had any idea that this was something I wanted to do. Everybody had to bring in something that mattered to them and share it with the rest of the class, you know, like a game of fucking show and tell.
Yeah.
And I get there and the first girl, she has a Blues Traveler CD and she's talking to the rest of the class about how her boyfriend gave her this Blues Traveler CD and she's crying her fucking eyes out. And I'm like, this is the craziest girl I've ever seen. You know, why is this CD so fucking important to her? And, you know, for 15 minutes, she's going on about it. And then the next person with a teddy bear, the same shit. And I'm like, I just cannot believe how important this shit is. But it's slowly dawning on me that in this fucking circle, it's going to come to me. And I didn't bring anything. I got nothing, you know? And
did you have your baseball hat?
Well, what I did have, actually, I was going to baseball practice right afterwards. I was a catcher, so I had my catcher's glove.
Yeah.
So I get my glove. And I just launch into this fucking story about how my mother had given me this glove on her deathbed.
Did she? No.
No, she's alive and well in D.C., man. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I'm just lying my fucking ass off. But I look around the room and everyone is crying their fucking eyes out. I'm crying my eyes out. It's like this. And I'm like, whoa, hang on, man. This is just the acting, you know? Yeah. And Alma, she took
did
me
aside.
Did
you cop to it?
I copped to it to Alma. Uh-huh. And Alma really, for all the shit I had done in my life, she made me, I just felt fucking awful about it. But I think it was because I'd never exposed myself like that. And what she said is, you need to come audition for my play. That was kind of my punishment. And I did. And, you know, it was with all these, you know, older theater majors who took it so seriously and lived it. And they really, you know, they really welcomed me in and they saw something in me. And then, you know, Alma really, I think above all else, there was just, she just, it was so, you know, she's this beautiful actor who came out of San Francisco, was in a bunch of Shepherd plays, you know, original Shepherd plays out of the Magic Theater in San Francisco. But this,
did you ever play Lee?
I did Fool for Love and I did
True West.
I didn't do True West. Oh. No, I did Fool for Love and I did Cowboy Mouth.
Oh, yeah. Cowboy Mouth.
Yeah, yeah. We did scenes from it. I did the whole play of Fool for Love.
Oh.
But
that's interesting to me that still I'm a little hung up on the bullshit impact in the way that that, like, you know, you're seeing these people and your brain just sort of like, what the fuck, like, and then you go just make up something
full fucking bore,
but it does connect with you and you do have the feelings.
That's it.
So I imagine the sense of being a natural actor is that if you could pull that off, like I guess my question is, in that class, that you feel like you got vulnerable, but you were still making something up. Was there a point where, you know, you were able to access, you know, really who you were in the sense with true stories and stuff?
You know, I don't know that I said anything that was truthful in that class. I remember there's one part specifically where I just, and you know, now even thinking about it, it's so fucking ridiculous, but how my brother and I would go and have a catch and think about mom, which is such a, it's like such a perverse thought, but because it's so thought out.
Right.
But you know, the way that we would do, and I remember but seeing it and believing in it and having this kind of out of body experience and saying, I want more of this.
Yeah, right,
man.
I want this. Right.
This is all right. Right. You know? And it wasn't, you know, I had been in situations where I'm talking to a principal or an administrator where I'm lying through my teeth, and if I got over on him, I'd walk out and be like, got him, you know, like bullet dodged. Yeah. You know what I mean? But I had also remembered times. I remember being a young kid and taken into the principal's office because I like sixth grade, I had a switchblade and I had, you know, done something, pulled it on a kid, some shit. And I remember the principal asking me about that and I had it in my pocket and, you know, breaking down in tears being like, I would never do that. And it's right there, you know, like burning a hole in my pocket. And, I don't know. There was something different about, I didn't feel like it was as much as, you know, duping anybody. I felt maybe what it was my mom, who had always said, hey, man, you have this, you can do this. And for the first time saying, you know, maybe I kind of can.
But it's sort of funny to me because I've talked to a lot of actors and some of them will just, you know, basically say it's pretending. It's, that's what you're doing. You're
believing
pretending
it fully. Yeah. I think so. And then I think then through diving all in the way that I did from that point on.
Well, what was the Russia thing? How does that happen? I never heard that before. She just says, go to Russia? I mean, what was in Russia?
The Moscow Art Theater. So I moved. I lived in a place called Park Kultury, which is Gorky Park.
They had a program for what? You were, what, second year of college? Or
No, it wasn't a college program. It was just part of the Moscow Art Theater.
So you dropped out of school?
I was done, dropped out. And went to Russia.
And she was supportive of that?
Big time. Big time. She was my advisor, too.
Alma was. So Alma, you dropped out as a sophomore?
Junior.
Uh-huh.
Yep, junior year was
And
my
you go to
year.
Russia.
That's right.
You told your parents, I want to do this thing, and they're
this
like,
this is what I want to do.
All yeah. right.
There was pro baseball over there. I got on a pro baseball team, played a little bit of baseball.
You found out in town where the pro baseball was?
It was part of the European Professional Baseball Federation. I'm not even sure how I found that. But school there was ridiculously all-encompassing.
You know, how long were you there?
I was there the first time I was there a little over a year, and then I went back because ART, Harvard's got a graduate school for acting. They take their students to Russia to get taught for a semester.
So you're in Russia the first time. You're playing pro ball in Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a baseball card to you?
No, Russia? Definitely not. No.
A Russian baseball card would be very great.
Would be awesome.
That'd
be awesome.
But so all encompassing. So what do you mean? What is the training? So this is like because this is where I believe probably at least in Russia, where some of the big thinkers of modern acting,
it's everything, man,
happened.
Yeah. 100%. Right? Yeah, it's Chekhov's theater, Stanislavski's theater, Meyerhold, Michael Chekhov. You know, it's the theater, and you know, you're talking about a place where you know, and my teacher's kind of coming out of this world where you know all public gathering in Russia was outlawed. You know, there were state sanctioned theaters, the Moscow Art Theater being one of them. But you know, you had shows that were sanctioned by the state. But once the government would start to sort of figure out, hey, this artist that we're celebrating that's doing these pro-Russian plays, there's actually something a little bit behind it there.
Yeah.
I don't know if we like this anymore. And all of a sudden, these guys were getting assassinated and sent to Siberia, artists. You know, Meyerhold, a great, brilliant director of the Moscow Art Theater, was assassinated in his apartment.
For being subversive.
Right, and at one time completely celebrated by the state. It was just a difference of opinion, you know? And you know, my teachers, you know, they came from, you know, one of my teachers, Igor, he, to avoid the war in Afghanistan, he pretended to be crazy and lived 3 years in an insane asylum. My three teachers.
That's a real commitment to a role.
Brother, Igor, Sergey, and Roman. The three best friends, they all went to school together, and they would do this play in secret called Cinzano. And basically what they would do is they would do it in subway tunnels and in different locations all around Moscow, and people would go and see it during communist times. And if they had got caught, they would have all been arrested.
Right.
And it was a play that just continued and continued and continued.
With them or with others?
Always with them.
Yeah.
But when you think about the vitality, that thing that Alma was talking about how important this is and to take it so seriously and what is on, what is at stake, I think for me, a kind of I thought of myself as this big, bad, tough guy from D.C. to go to Moscow in the late 90s and to be taught by these motherfuckers who, you know, and to be in a city where you talk about dangerous, you talk about alive, you talk about wild.
You were badass.
Oh, my God, man. Oh, my God. I mean, I learned very, very quick that I was not in Kansas anymore. But, you know, at the same time, you know, there was such a reverence for the arts there.
Well, like,
you know?
what was the program? Because, like, what strikes me is that, you know, when you get the American method, you know, there's all these middlemen, like Uta Hagen and
Meisner
and the other one, Strasburg, the group theater.
Yeah, the group all that whole group.
But they were taking, you know, I think maybe Strasburg had met with Stanislavski.
It was based on one tour of the show. So their first show was The Seagull. And
Which one, the group theater or who?
Moscow Art Theater.
Okay.
Yeah, I got this tattoo here for it. It's like so that's the symbol of the Moscow Art Theater. It's so basically the first show that they did was called The Seagull.
Yeah.
You know, Chekhov wrote it obviously, and Stanislavski directed it and acted in it. And they took this play on a world tour through England, Paris, and then through New York, Chicago, LA, and San Francisco, and it was just that for the first time actors, you know, not standing on the foot of the stage proclaiming to the audience, but for the first time really talking to each other and, wow, they're really drinking tea. And that motherfucker just turned his back to the audience. And, you know, this
naturalism,
realism, whatever you want to call it, it drove people crazy.
And
then it was all about how do we now sit down? How do we get this little bit of time that we have with this guy? How do we translate his books, take the information that he has and make it our own? And what I think is, look, man, I'm definitely no expert, you know, but I, to me, I think that is the process of coming up with an acting method. We all have to have our own.
Sure.
And it's all about taking in as much fucking information as we can and then figuring out what works for us. And I think that's exactly what those guys did, you know.
But you were there sort of at the source, like the people that you were working with were kind of direct legacies of that.
I think so. I mean, they all, but what was really interesting is there was no one method from them. Look, you have to do acrobatics, you have to do ballet.
Like, what do you mean acrobatics?
Like, so that's like in
trapeze.
No, it's flips. Not that kind of acrobatics. Yeah, it's more about getting training your body to, you know, walk on your hands, to be able to do things with partners, to lift people, and to be able to make performance just out of body movement,
right.
To use props in a way,
clowning,
all that kind of stuff. Yes, yes, and then ballet as well. You know, we'd have a Bolshoi ballerina. She would come in. She would.
At the ballet? You did pretty good.
I was all right. I would be terrible now. I've not kept up with it.
No one's asking you to use your ballet chops.
I'm waiting for that phone call to ring, man.
Next role.
Yeah,
you're going to switch it up, man. You're going to be the morally corrupt bloody guy for your entire career.
Shit, man. Shit, help.
So, all right, so you're doing all that and you're doing plays in Moscow?
Yeah, doing plays in Moscow. I mean, it's interesting. In the first year, I mean, the way that Russian theater training works, it's quite different. I mean, first of all, the teachers, the highest honor you can get as an actor in Russia is to be a teacher.
Right.
So my teacher, you know, Oleg Tabakov, that would be like, you know, Robert De Niro or Philip Seymour Hoffman. That he's the teacher. You know, it's absolute reverence. It's such an honor to do it. It's not one of these things where, you know, if it doesn't really work out,
you're not working out of a strip mall in West Hollywood.
That's right. Yeah, that doesn't exist there.
A small black box situation. Other people.
Which, hey, God bless him. You know? But you know, it's very different there, and I think it's very brutal, it's very cutthroat, but it's extremely honest. So, you know, there's a huge audition process, and then when you get into the school, they cut the class in half every year.
How many were English speaking?
When I was there,
yeah.
When I was there, none. I mean, there was one girl from England.
In Russian?
Yeah, but I had a translator. I had a translator for they provide a translator if you get into
that's
the
crazy.
Yeah. It was wonderful. And I was at the theater every night, seeing plays in Russian, understanding every fucking thing because it was so clear. People were playing their actions so clearly, and I mean, really, man. Overall, you know, there was a. I, for lack of a better word, there's sort of just a masculinity to being an actor there and an artist there that for me at that time in my life really, really resonated with
because it wasn't based in like outlaw bullshit. It was a masculinity based in arts.
Fuck yeah. And instead of sort of this coddling kind of, hey, we can do no wrong, come to the theater department where, you know, yes, we're all great and wow, beautiful. Yeah. It was, you're not good at this, get the fuck out. You're good at this, work harder. And I really responded to it. It was much more athletic. It was much more cutthroat. And it really worked with me. And I'm will always be grateful to it and to
So when you come back from Russia the first time, then you end up at Harvard?
Yeah, so they took their students over there to get taught by these Russian masters. They saw me in a show and they asked me.
The Harvard guys, yeah, the ART.
Like, they're like, you want to come to Harvard? I was like, shit, man, I didn't even finish. Yeah, God, like
I'll
me?
Go to Harvard. I went to Harvard.
Just tell my old man I go to Harvard? Like, you know what I mean? I can stop after that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And you know, I had been playing baseball with a bunch of guys who, you know, some South Boston guys, crazy motherfuckers, man. And so I lived with these guys while I was.
If you went to Harvard living with guys from South Boston.
Brother,
bunch of Wahlbergs.
Oh, dude. So that was a crazy experience.
I lived up there. Those guys were rough.
Yeah, big time, man. Big time. Crazy.
So you had a new crew.
Oh, yeah. Totally new crew. And I was kind of, you know, I still stupidly kind of had one foot in, 1 foot out. But I knew as far as this acting thing was good, that was it for me.
Well, that's funny about that 1 foot, because if you got the right guys going, come on,
that's it. But what was crazy is all my friends always, you know, whether they were athlete friends or criminal friends or whatever, through my whole life, they always supported me doing this, and they always, you know, I'll never forget when my college baseball team saw me in my first show in the Scarlet Letter. They all came. And they all say, hey, man, you suck at baseball compared to this. Like, you can do this, man. And that felt, that really,
because they can't do
never,
it.
Yeah, and there was never this sort of thing of like, oh, you're a
pussy.
I think they, yeah, none of that shit, man. Yeah. I never, that never happened. Never happened.
So, like, but the thing I was going to ask you, where's your Jewish roots from? Are they Russian?
Yeah.
Wait, what kind of Jew are you at this point?
Never. I mean, you know, man.
Were you bar mitzvahed?
No.
Oh, really? So.
Yeah. No, I'm bad. Yeah, I'm bad.
But was it an option, or your family just didn't give a shit?
I think I could, if I wanted to do it.
But were you brothers?
One of my brothers was. Hmm. You know, and I think that you know, for me, I just it was not even on the radar.
Were you fascinated at all with the genealogy of you and being in Russia, or did you have any connection that way? Did you see people that looked like you, kind of? Or
you know,
I guess most of the Jews pushed out.
Brother, but, yeah, I mean, yeah, like, yeah, they not did not. Many. I mean, I honestly was fascinated by being in Russia. I was fascinated, but you know, that place was such a. I mean, it was while I was there. It was the Wild West, and
right.
I think that, you know, the brutality and the danger, things that always really fascinate. Yeah. You know, there were shootouts at the Duma
while
I was
there. That was your religion. Yeah.
That was my so that I was just like, holy shit. But at the same time, again, I think this, you know, you get on the subway there and you got people reading Bulgakov and Tolstoy. It's not Us Weekly and fucking People. You know, like there's this absolute reverence and respect for the arts and for literature and for Russian actors and Russian. You know, my best friend there is this guy named Dima, who, you know, I lived in this really shitty part of town called Park Kultury, and every night when I'd walk home, him and his buddies, they would be like drinking a 2-liter bottle of vodka, and they call me Bloodhound Gang because they said I look like the guy from Bloodhound Gang. They just make fun of me every night. And one night I saw him in a fight with a couple skinheads, and there were three of them and one of him. And for some reason, I decided to go help the guy out.
For some reason, you're like, finally.
No, not at all, man. Yeah. I'm not, you know. But like, I helped him out, and he and I became really close. And he was just this guy who, he's basically this street kid, but he knew every member of the Moscow Art Theater. He knew everything that was at the Bolshoi. You know, he went to the Taganka Theater. It was just that steeped in this thing.
But
it was like, that was the thing there. It was not like this kind of highbrow. You know, the theater was not for rich subscribers who are all falling asleep during shows.
It was,
you know,
vital,
it was
like you're saying,
fucking vital, man. Yeah. And you know, there's not a single free seat at any theater. People, there's no fire code, so people are sitting on the steps, and people have to get in there, and the seats are enormously cheap. And you know, just the way of doing, you know, when you do a show in Russia, the way it works is you decide to do the play and then you rehearse it open-ended until the director says it's time to go up.
But when you were acting, you were speaking English?
When I was, I mean, I did some scene work, and, you know, after a while I started to pick it up, and I got okay. But the scene work that I did and the plays that I did, I would act in English, yeah.
So when you go to Harvard, now ART, like, I know that area. I lived in Boston for years. So, like, that's Harvard Square at that time, before it was sort of gutted of its personality. You still had the Tasty, where you could get a hamburger on the corner, right?
Yeah.
All night.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Yeah.
But you could always go to Somerville or wherever. But so, like, what were you... Did you stand out there? I mean, because it seems to me that, like, in terms of your disposition, you're pretty unique in acting in general. I mean, did you find that you were different than the rest of them when you were at Harvard? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Big time. Yeah, big time. I think even more so. I think the only the place where I felt sort of the most kinship, or the most where the other actors were sort of like me, was in Russia. You know, where it was really... Which was crazy, because a lot of the people in Russia were, like, you know, from the mountains, you know, and they had their whole 16 people, their 16 people and their family living in their little dorm room, eating off hot plots, off of hot plates, you know, nothing like me. But I felt such a kinship with them that, you know, I have nothing the same as you. It's all on the line. And, like, you know, it wasn't the case.
So what did you do at ART? Which plays? What?
Oh, man, I did a lot. Yeah, I did a lot. You know, We did Murat Saad with this great Hungarian director. You know, ART is a really cool theater because it's real director driven, and you know, it's always, you know, classic plays with real contemporary takes and great directors. So, you know, Robert Woodruff and Janos Saz and Yuri Uriman came over from Russia, and we got to go back to Russia, but this time as an ART student. So all of a sudden you're in clean rooms and locked doors,
really?
And I saw a whole other side of Moscow, the sort of the Western side of it, which I did not like nearly as much, but it was great to kind of go back and be the guy that had been there and to sort of take all these kids through. And you know, like, I it was my home at
that
point.
Yeah, you knew Russia.
And I was really, You know, it's strange. I when we landed in Russia as an ART student, I remember just landing at Sheremetyevo, the airport there, and I just, you know, for no reason at all, I just kind of broke down in tears, you know, and I wasn't, you know, and I just kind of hid, and the place just, the place really is my heart, man, and you know, I loved it there.
It's amazing. So you studied at Harvard for a couple of years?
Yeah, and then I started doing all the shows there, and then, you know, you do like a showcase to get agents and all that stuff, and that's sort of like the big
promise.
At ART? Yeah, yeah, well, you go to New York and you do it. So, you know, I got my agent, and then I boned out. You know? Yeah, yeah.
You didn't finish?
I didn't. You know, it was really one of those things that was... I thought when I was I this is no offense to my fellow classmates there, but you know there's a lot of great people in that class, people I got really, really close with. I really thought that when I got into that school and that I was going to that school, that I was really gonna be like in Moscow, I was gonna be with the best of the best.
Right.
And then when I saw everybody and I saw It really wasn't the case. I
mean, there's some people that wasn't as defined.
Well, I just thought, wow, we're gonna have 2 years of people who just, you know, we're gonna do is just make the greatest shit ever, and we're all gonna dive into this, and we're all gonna want this so bad. And it's really not what I found. And then what I started to see in the second year, you know, a lot of the kids were sort of saying, hey, this isn't fair. You know, some people are getting more roles than others, and it was just this shit that I just couldn't wrap my head around, especially after my experience in Russia, which is a total meritocracy, you know. And and so what I did is I snuck out of school one day. You can never miss, but I called in sick and I snuck down to D.C. and auditioned for This Is Our Youth. They were doing it at the Studio Theater, the Kenny Lonergan play.
Yeah.
And I got so I went back to my school and I said, hey, listen, you know, like, I know we have another semester, but I got this play and I think I can get more out of going to do this play. And they actually were really cool about it. They said they understood and they wished me well. And the truth is, I couldn't have gotten a degree from there anyway because I didn't have a college degree. So it was, it all worked out. And then I did that and then went straight to doing a play at the Ontological with my old theater company. And then I started to, slowly but surely started to work in film and TV, which I really...
But how long, were you living in New York?
Yeah, living in New York. I didn't really have my first sort of half year in New York didn't even have a place to stay. I was kind of couch surfing. And
were you doing like little shitty plays but little kind of like off Broadway kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, I was doing stuff. You know, we did Arturo Uy, the Brecht play with my theater company. It was right at
the
time.
Oh, you had a theater company?
The same theater company.
Oh, the guys from Skidmore.
Because they had moved down to New York and they had, now they've got this theater called the Bushwick Star, but this was Bushwick back in the 90s, you know, it was a very, very different place. And my theater company was sort
what
of
was
the
it
first
called?
People. It's called Fovea Floods Theater Company.
Uh-huh.
This genius writer-director named Josh Chambers.
Yeah. He'd
write all his own plays and choreograph them, and then went on to direct plays in Europe. And he was a Cal Arts director, and then... You know, he kind of, you know, drugs and all kinds of stuff.
Lost it. He's still around?
He is, and it's tough. You know, he's, you know, crazy things have sort of been going on with him. And, and he's literally, I can say 100% to this day, of all the brilliant people I've worked with, he was the most brilliant. He's the best artist I've ever worked with in my life. And he was just one of those guys who just, you know, he would stay up all night and write a book. You know, he would write music. You know, he's a filing scholar, like one of the best classical guitarists in the country. Just like, it's just too much going on, big time, man, big time to everything. But man, you know, it was such a beautiful thing we had because there was like 16 of us living in this warehouse space in Bushwick, rehearsing all day, then putting our shows up at the Ontological in the city, and then rehearsing four more plays and just eating together and training together. And it was really a beautiful kind of pure thing. And right about at that time was when I started to get these sort of like guest spots, you know, my Law and Order spots. And I felt like it was such a betrayal and such,
going from that to sort of like the set of Law and Order.
Fuck, man. Or even just to audition for that shit. And you know, this thing that was so pure and so what I had new in my heart,
this is what makes me feel alive.
This is it, man. And you know, what I wanted more than anything.
Live,
you know,
crazy theater.
I wanted the Wooster Group, man.
Willem
Dafoe, he's my hero.
Yeah.
He's like, that's what I wanted. And you know, if I ended up doing movies down the road, fine. Time, but
did you ever go over there?
My center. I would watch shows there.
But did you ever try to get in?
You know, we were so busy with our stuff that we always had something going on. But yeah.
So how'd you kind of justify or rationalize?
Fully betray my own
what was the thinking around, you know, accepting that mm-hmm. as the way your life was going to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think the rationale behind it was they were doing a Lanford Wilson play in New York, the 5th of July.
Yeah.
Parker Posey was in it, and Eben Moss Backrack, and David Harbour, and Robert Sean Leonard. And
Harbour's out there.
Fuck yeah, man. Yeah, man. My gig in the show was to be the it was right when I got out of school. I was the male understudy, so I got to learn all the parts, go watch these guys every single night, and then do these sort of understudy rehearsals where I would play all I think four of the male parts.
Yeah.
And you know what I saw was that, you know, the people, what I really wanted to do was I really wanted to do serious theater in New York. And I saw Parker Posey and I saw what she was doing and I saw that people were coming to the theater to see her. And I sort of strategically, you know, was telling myself at the time, the only way I'm going to be able to do this is if I have a career and
know who I am.
It's the only way. It's the only way you get these parts. And I'm looking around like that's who's doing it. Like every fucking show is a guy from
right. They have a profile, but they also know how to do theater.
Exactly. But like you know, for me at that point, I had done so much of it. I you know, whether it was stupid or not, in my mind, I wasn't the least bit worried about that. But,
right.
So I decided to kind of go after that full force.
Right. To become a recognized actor in the bigger picture so you could draw on the theater.
I think so. I mean, I think at first it was just sort of like, let's go after these, you know, guest star spots and let's really pour into those things.
Well, how did you pour into those? I mean, how does that become satisfying for a guy like you? I mean, I do TV now and mm-hmm. it's like there's a lot of waiting and mm-hmm. you're actually acting for about you know, 2 minutes at a time,
sure.
if not less.
Sure.
So how does that satisfy you? How do you wrap your brain or make your brain think that that's satisfying?
Well, I think it was deeply naive and kind of pathetic, to be honest with you, to sort of think that you have a kind of understanding of something that you have literally no experience
which
in.
Which is what?
Which is TV? Acting in front of a camera.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I think that, you know, for me, once I got out there and I started doing it and I ended up doing this... I ended up doing this little independent film called Day Zero with Lizzie Moss was in it and Ginny Goodwin and Elijah Wood and Chris Klein and I remember I'd gone to the audition for this thing they were only seeing people for like hot dog vendor number one or the, you know, and I kind of went into the audition. I loved this script and I loved this character so much. And I went to Alma and she and I had worked on it together and I learned the whole script. And when I came in, they said, what role are you auditioning for? And I said, Dixon was the lead. And they said, okay, well, we're not auditioning people for that. And I said, well, look, I've got some stuff prepared. Can I just show you what I'm thinking? They said, all right, what scene do you want to do? And I said, I know the whole script. So sort of as a, you know, just to test me, they were like, all right, let's start at the beginning. And we ended up doing it. And they ended up casting me. And I fell in love with this process. You know, the guy like lived on top of a roof. So I moved into the, you know, I did all the sort
Methody
of
stuff.
Stupid young actor bullshit. And you know,
how long did you live on top of a roof?
For the whole shoot, you know? Yeah. And you know, it was just one of those things where there was a strategy to it and there was
a different way of thinking about acting.
A different way of thinking, man, that I absolutely fell in love with. And I said, wow, there is so much to learn here. There's so much potential here. It's so electric. And I think for me, like exactly what you say, that, you know, our whole thing now as actors is to hone our lives and to position ourselves emotionally, physically, in every way, just for these few seconds between action and cut, that's the game. Like that's the, and that is totally invigorating for me and exciting to me.
Okay, you know? So but what about you've done your 3 minutes,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So now we're going to switch out a lens. We're gonna move the cameras. Mm-hmm. What do you do in that time?
Well, so you have a choice, right?
Yeah.
You can either. And I think that's the sort of thing when we get back to, you know, Stanislavski and all this shit. What's
your method?
To stay in it or not. And it's all, for me, it's about proximity to whatever that heat is and whether that is just, you know, you need to be fully relaxed and fully engaged with the person you're in the scene with, or do you need to be close to this fire inside you to be where you think this person needs to be?
Well, with something like The Punisher, which, mm-hmm. you know, like I hadn't watched and I'm like, well, I better watch it. So I watched episode one, and then like last night I'm on six, and like I got real into it. I think that guy, the Punisher as a character, I dig. But like something like that. So you're shooting that thing. That seems to be heavily require a lot out of you.
Yeah, I mean,
so like when you're not shooting during that, are you staying in it?
Yeah, I think I think the more that you do it, the more you kind of know your
drop
body.
Into
you know
it.
You know what it is. But yeah, definitely in the beginning, and definitely when I took the role on, big time. Especially, I think it was a real privilege to be able to do it at first. When I started playing it,
in the Daredevil,
it was on
suit?
Daredevil, yeah. Right? So like you know when you're not number one right. guy on the call sheet,
yeah.
you can sort of just be the guy in the corner pacing, and nobody's coming up to you and asking you. You know, it's a little bit different when you're. You know, I've really been lucky to work with, you know, really great leads in my life, and I really, you know, like Emily Blunt or DiCaprio or Brad Pitt, got people who are, you know, unbelievably welcoming, and part of the job is making people feel comfortable. That's the challenge for me as far as doing the you know, how do you stay, how do you control your proximity to the character while also taking care of the people, taking care of the crew, to being there, being
a decent guy,
being a decent guy, and being accessible because I've been the guy who just shows up for the day, and I want everybody who's there to feel, hey man, you can explore here, you can go big here, you can go for it, you can feel comfortable, have ideas, like, and you look, it's Marvel, man, you know, you got a million fucking cooks, and so I it's really important for me for the artists and for the crew to feel supported and that's kind of the challenge. That's kind of the challenge there with that.
So you're doing these bit parts, you know, New York, and you're doing the guest shots that mm-hmm. everyone does in New York. And what was the first movie outside of the independent one?
The first movie that I did? I think the first sort of bigger movie that I did was World Trade Center.
Oh yeah,
which was crazy. A crazy.
I kind of
like
that movie though.
Yeah, it was.
It was heavy, right?
You know, it was very heavy. But you know, it was 5 years after. You know, when we did it, it was. You know, but I think that was sort of my first experience, especially with a big budget movie of what's possible in terms of research. You know, Oliver Stone is, you know, extremely into that, and you know, I played this guy, small part, but you know, a guy named Chris Amoroso, who left the youngest widow of all the first responders. His wife, Jamie, his daughter, Sophia, was one. He's a guy who was at the bus terminal, was at Port Authority. They called him BT Dogs. And that morning got stationed at World Trade Center and was super pissed off about it because nothing ever happens at World Trade Center. And he went up that day. He went up to where the planes hit. He grabbed a woman, carried her down. Something fell on him, and he sliced off half of his ear. He carried her to safety all the way down. When he got down exhausted, covered in blood, there's this picture of Chris. He saw his best friends all coming in because they had just come from the bus terminal. He set her down, got her to safety, and went back up and never made it out. And, you know, it was a real – you know, when I got cast in that, you know, I wrote his widow, Jamie. I wrote her this letter, just sort of asking permission to be a part of it, and you know, inviting her to be as much of a process as memorializing. You know, any bit of truth that she could add about Chris would be great. And you know, the studio kind of shut that. They're like, "Look, kid, you're in like two scenes in this movie. Like, you know, it's very, very, very delicate, the relationship with the widows, and it was all, you know, enormously fresh. And I think that there is a whole component of that movie which I found super truthful, where in the script, every time these guys were going into the building, the one thing that was uniform among all of them, all cell phone services was stopped. You couldn't call anybody.
Yeah.
So all they would say is, "Hey, man, if I don't make it out of here, you tell Jamie that you tell Chris, you tell," and all of that as a whole, because it was so delicate, and I don't know whether how it was handled, but all of that got pulled out. Basically, all of the widows said, "Hey, we don't want our names mentioned in this." All of the and it changed it drastically, and I was really sort of sad that I couldn't, you know, reach
Jamie.
Right, but you know, Oliver, one of the things that, you know, he's sort of famous for, and he's so brilliant at, is, you know, he had us there a month and a half before, and he said, "Look." He brought us to the bus terminal. I met all Chris's friends, Officer Fairbanks, Sergeant Finney, and he said, "You can spend as much time as these guys as you want." And I started going out with these guys every single fucking day, and we became like this, and they told me all this shit about Chris. And as a surprise at the end, they connected me with her. And, you know, it was such a cool honor. And, you know, I think, you know, that's really what was the beginning for me, and what's carried me over in terms of what I really, really love about this business and this job, and what I'm so grateful for, is the folks that I get to meet, man, in the research and the people that open up and you know, it doesn't, you know, whether it's a soldier or a teacher or any, you know, people who invite you into their lives, and this desire that I think is really in everybody to have their stories told and to be told authentically with the bruises and the ugliness included. It's such an honor, and it's such a treasure if you get somebody to do that.
Yeah. How did she feel about your performance? Do you know?
Yeah. She was great, man. You know, she reached out. We always sort of communicated on Christmas for some reason. But she, you know, said really kind things.
And, oh, that's nice.
I didn't really do enough in the movie to make a crazy impact.
Right.
You know, I always, you know, in the little bit of publicity I did for the movie, I always talked about her and about Sophia.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
And with with Wolf, and I imagine working with these guys. I don't know I can't remember who you were directly working with on that movie. But in Wolf of Wall Street, I mean, you were one of the guys, the outsider, the drug dealer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I imagine when you work with Pitt on Fury, mm-hmm. was that it? Mm-hmm. That you know, you do learn from them, you know, watching how they handle themselves, and you know, I just did a scene with Mark Wahlberg, and for some reason, I always speak at this level, I'm always on, you know, speaking at on stage level,
sure,
and I'm doing a scene with him, and he's like, yeah, okay, man, and then there's that moment where you realize I don't have to shout, you know, but I also realize I shout all the time. It's who I am.
Do
I have to start worrying about maybe I should try talking like I never talk, which is a normal level.
But
there's just little things that you pick up in talking to and just watching those guys work. Cause those guys, Pitt's a really pretty amazing actor.
Brilliant, man.
You know?
I mean, I kind of feel like they all are. I mean, I feel like you're there, you know, for a reason. You know, I just did this movie with Matt Damon and
he's the best.
Christian Bale. Yeah, man.
Oh my God.
And a totally different kind of part for me. You know, I play Lee Iacocca in this movie, Mango.
So they fatten you up and they balded you?
Well, it's Lee. It's, you know, it's in the 60s.
Oh,
the
young
takes
Lee
place
Iacocca.
In 66. But you know, I look at, you know, and I've always been such an enormous fan of Matt's.
Yeah.
But God, and a lot of my stuff, it was with him and Tracy Letts, who, by the way, on the show
was
the best. He's the
I
best.
Love
coolest
him.
Motherfucker on earth.
Yeah.
But you know, Matt, it is so damn good. He's so damn good and such a good person and an open person, an honest person. And, you know, I think you said it, man. It's learning from them across the board, you know,
well, how does a guy like you get smaller?
You know, man, I think that I think part of it is you gotta be confident enough to, and I think this is probably the boxer in me, and this is probably this is something where that stuff really.
You still box?
I do. Yeah, I'll always box, and I think for me, it's
how do we miss that part of the story? How long have you been boxing?
Oh man. 25 years. That guy Sean that I was telling about, we came up together, but you know, I think that you have to you at the end of the day, when you get in there, you have to remember, hey man, everybody puts on their pants one leg at a time. That's a man.
Oh yeah,
I'm
of course.
And you know, it's not, you know, I think if you go in, you know, but
watching their choices, you know, watching their action.
Watching their choices, watching how they handle themselves both on set and off, you know, and look, each one of them is different and sometimes, but I all these people that you mentioned and you know, DiCaprio definitely in there as well, you know, these are all people that are just staggering human beings.
Well,
know?
Now, the DiCaprio, the character in Wolf, that was a real guy. Mm-hmm. Did you go meet that guy?
Well, the guy who I played had passed.
Oh.
But the guy who Leo played, yeah, he was, you know, but Scorsese's interesting. He doesn't like the real people to be around. You know,
yeah.
He likes to get the story. And then he, you know, that was the mountaintop, that movie. You know, I
love
really
that movie.
I every day you just did not know what was going to happen. It was all improvisation.
It was?
It was the entire thing. You never knew which way it was going to go. You know, there's that whole section in that movie. I don't know how well you know the movie, but that whole thing is sell me this pen. You know, that came about that day that we shot that scene in the diner. Leo happened to be the security guard. The guy who was doing Leo's security for that day was a New York City detective. And when they were walking from the trailer to set to that diner scene, he said, you know, I had a job interview with the real Jordan Belfort back in the 90s. And yeah. Leo said, oh, yeah? He's like, just making small talk. And he said, you know what he did in the interview? He pulled out a pen and said, sell me this pen. And so Leo just threw that out in the scene and we just improvised it. You know what I mean? But it was that in the moment, that alive, you know, whatever.
It feels that way.
No conversation. Hey, let's try that. And, I've never felt more watched by a director. I've never felt, you know, these, you know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I the thing I hate more than anything is saying, hey, so I kind of had this idea and I want to see if I could, like, you know, Marty makes everybody feel 100 feet tall, everybody, extras, everybody, throw things out there, try things, but he sees it. It's not just, so sometimes when you're pitching on camera, it's like, oh, did he see it? But he saw every little fucking thing for what it was.
Yeah.
And then could say, great, or don't do that, one or the other.
Right.
And there was a level of play on that movie that, unlike any place I'd ever been before.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah, it was cool.
And, the thing I liked about that movie was just the escalating levels of testosterone. Like they show those traitors in that room, and by the end of the movie, they were doing backflips, and they're like, it was really a nice element. Yeah. But so, like, are you happy that you got out from under The Walking Dead?
Yeah, you know, I think
you did like 20 of them?
Yeah, I did the first 2 years.
I mean, yeah,
at that time in my life, I think Frank Darabont, I mean, that was a strange thing because, you know, Frank was such a instrumental part of that show and you know, he got fired off of it,
right.
You know, really sort of in an abrupt and acute way and that we never really understood. And I think for me, I was so unbelievably grateful to be doing that show.
Right.
You know, finally, we're on a show. The show was super successful, and it was kind of tailor-made. It was right in my wheelhouse and showing something. You know, I'd been doing, like, sitcoms and shit before that, stuff that I just don't think I was very good at. And I loved that character. It was such a beautiful character that had a real arc. It had real buoys along the journey that, you could really show something with. And I thought, sort of just my luck, I finally get on this hit show, and then I get fucking killed off of it. But definitely looking in retrospect, you know, doing the show was one of the best things that happened in my career, and getting killed off of the show was equally as
good. Well,
because
those kind of things become a soap opera eventually.
That's it. There's no way to sustain it.
And you could be stuck there for your entire career.
Still, yeah. And I think that, you know, for me, the people you meet along the way is always the thing to take away. It's always the most important part of this thing. And I think that, you know, those people, those original actors from The Walking Dead, they're still some of my best friends in the world.
And
we're all, you know, enormously close and totally a part of each other's lives.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's great.
You're a gregarious guy that has a real sort of passion and interest with other people. It's nice.
Cherry Jones came and spoke at ART. I flew back up for the graduation, even though I didn't graduate. And I remember she said, you know, in this business, she said, let me give you three pieces of advice. She said, always live within your means. Don't change your life financially just because things are going well or things are going bad. Try to keep it even. Never base your personal happiness on your career success. And always, always remember, above all else, it's about the humans you meet along the way. Be a human being. And I've been with artists that I really, really respect. I've worked with actors that I really, really respect who totally disagree with that, who say, fuck this, man. This is not about making friends. I don't give a fuck if you like me. This is about what happens between action and cut. That lasts forever. You know, man, it's just not who I am, man. It's not what I believe in. Like, I really think that being decent and being kind and the relationships are really important and the best part of this thing, what you take away, and it all becomes part of who you are as an artist, and it informs you in so many different ways. And, you know, to let that armor down and I think that's, I mean, that's my path.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you're fortunate to have some sort of grounded confidence about things, you know, because of the way you live your life. Like, because, like, for me, like, if I'm on a set, you know, which is relatively new to me, you know, to be working, you know, with other actors in a real, like I did my, but you know, with this thing I'm doing now with Glow, that a lot of times, like I just kind of keep to myself because I know it's not about me.
Sure.
And also like, you know, you give me 5 minutes, I might be walking around going like, how was that? Was that okay?
Yeah.
I'd rather be quiet guy than that guy. You know what I mean?
100%. 100%. And knowing, I think that, arrogance or you know, the second that you're arrogant or the second that you think you've got this fucking thing licked is the absolute enemy and absolute destruction. So it's like you just go to this place of like, oh, fuck that. I mean, everything I do, you know, I think artistically, I do tend to live in this place of like, oh, fuck, I fucked that up.
Really?
I do, man. And
but like what, with takes or with characters or like you, or you just like there's nothing that you've accomplished even after we talk about, you know, how amazing it is and how, you know, you've learned all these things about yourself and this good side of yourself, you know, still you walk away from The Wolf of Wall Street and say like, ah, fuck that.
You know, I think that there are certain processes and certain characters and certain things that I've done where I can look at the process. I can look at everything that happened. I can look at the relationships that I made where I say, wow, that was, we had some magic
but
that
you have
day.
To convince yourself?
It's a pretty high bar, man. I think, you know, like one thing a teacher told me that really resonated with me was, you know, one of the problems with things like a graduate school or problem with, you know, maybe going to the same comedy club every night or surrounding yourself with the same artist or being on a show for a long time is what you do is artistically you, whether you want to or not, you start comparing yourself to everybody in your immediate circle. And you say, well, you know, I might not be the best, but I'm definitely better than that guy. And although that guy had a great Tuesday night, you know, he's really kind of at the bottom of the
barrel.
I'm
more steady.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just like this stupid fucking narrative that means nothing. And this one teacher I had, you know, and maybe this is grandiose, but it's what he fucking said. You know, he said, you know, what you need to do as an artist is you need to have examples of perfection. And whether it's like one play that Michael Jordan made or a riff that Jerry Garcia played or, you know, whatever it is, it needs to be these little moments of perfection. You need to always compare your shit to that. Always.
To and other types of artists in particular?
Whatever. Artists, athletes, you need to know, you need to have.
So how do you win that game?
You don't. You don't. And I think like when you get back to the seagull.
You.
Maybe, but I think like, look, man, like when I go back to, you know, Alma and the seagull and what I think that play is about.
Yeah.
You know, to me, what that play is about is it's about all these different artists and their relationship with their dream, the health of the relationship that they have with their dream, with their art, right?
Okay.
And so you have all these different people, and if you know the play, you know, the reason why Chekhov called it a comedy and it's fucking ends with suicide and it's so fucking tragic is because you got all these people who are in love with the wrong people and this one loves this one and they're all so fucking miserable and they should just fucking figure it out. But the metaphor for the dream is the seagull, and Treplev's in love with Nina, calls her his seagull. That's his dream, to be with her. And when she won't love him because she's in love with a more successful older writer, what he does is he goes and he kills a fucking, he shoots a seagull and gives it to her, right?
Yeah.
And for me, what that play is always about is that the way to have a healthy relationship with your dream is like a seagull. There's no such thing as a seagull that you can have as a pet. It needs to be wild. It needs to be out in front of you. You need to be chasing it. It needs to be go in different directions. And you can't, the only way you can touch it or attain it is you got to kill it. And by killing it, it's over, man. Like, you have to chase it. You have to let it be something out in front of you.
But you think you can't chase it without feeling like you're never good enough?
Well, look, I think that just because I know that what I'm after is a healthy relationship with it does not mean by any means that I'm there, you know, and it's a journey. It's something that I'm striving towards. But I do think that sort of being like the feeling of, hey, I got this licked, you know, it takes the hunger away. And I think that that is, I think for me, that is the big thing that I really want to work on going forward is I want to figure out how to have a healthier relationship with the things that I'm trying to do that doesn't always go to a place of...
You're a piece of shit.
You piece of shit. You don't deserve to be here, you know? Because where that does drive me, hey, fight harder, go, 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 it potentially can get in the way.
Right. Well, I mean, because like, I mean, I've had that and like I still have that like with my primary craft, which is stand up. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll you know, even if like, you know, I don't necessarily get the recognition that some of my peers get. And my last special, I thought was great. And that, you know, and I know that I did all the work I could have. Mm-hmm. That was the best thing I did. But like, you know, here a year later or whatever it is when I'm building new stuff that I'm still sort of like, God damn it. Why can't I just... work in a different way to where I don't have to put it all on the line every fucking time to figure out, you know, a direction for a joke.
But is it self-judging the shit that you're, that is the process of self-judging and being hard on yourself on this, on this new one that you're doing? Is that the same process that you were?
Well, it's always been my process. My process is like you, like I get something out of, you know, being in the moment. So like, you know, I'm not writing jokes down. Like I'm going on stage with ideas, and then, you know, in that moment where I, the way I see it is that I have to be funny because I'm cornered. I've cornered myself. I don't know where it's going to come from. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know what I'm going to say. It's a defensive thing. It's like, you know, I imagine with boxing. It's like, you know, it's, you know, you don't know what it's going to take to, you know, to get into that guy's head, but you know, it, you've been up there enough to know it's going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, all right, so that's the game. But there are times where I say to myself, well, why can't I work differently so I have a little more protection up there? And clearly I don't want it.
But
that's not driving me, you know, to a spiral place, really. It's just part of my life, and I get it. And, you know, and I know myself enough to accept my process, you know, whatever the faults of it are. But when you're doing stuff like, you know, to when you're in the darkness, like self-hatred to, as a compulsion to make yourself better, I don't think that's something we do consciously. But you're saying that, you know, what I've had to investigate in my life is that if I'm doing things that make me feel bad, and I'm not talking about art, you know, what is it about carrying that shame that is fucking comfortable to me, and why do I have that?
Right.
Do you know?
It's tough because I think that I've always been really, really blessed with really, really solid support around me. Really, really good group of friends who I've had my whole life. Unbelievable wife, great kids, great, you know, great family, great. I've just, that's never, you know, so I think it's this idea that I can take anything. I can take anything because I got this support structure.
But is that true? But it seems to me that at some points you must think like you don't deserve any of that.
Sure.
So what is that?
Well, I mean, deserve is a funny thing. I just think that it's, we have these processes, you know, we have this process for art, and up until this point.
But this pre-existed art in your life, no? I mean, like, I have to assume that when you're getting busted and you're having to bullshit your way out of situations, that you didn't, you know, walk away, whatever the success was in getting away with it, you didn't feel good about yourself, did you?
No. Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Man.
Yeah, fuck.
I don't know. Like, I don't know what that is, because that's part of it. Yeah. That's like almost a bigger component than the action is staying in that.
Sure.
And I can't, you know, I can look at my parents, I can look at whatever, but I can't always quite understand what that is. Like, there's something about that feeling that is grounding. That's home.
I know that. But I also think that those few times, like, you look at that special that you just did and that you feel good about you know, I don't know. Would you want to be the guy who felt like that all the time? Like, I, you know, like, wow, my shit, I'm great. Like, I don't know. I just feel
it's impossible, right? It's not an option. You know?
Exactly. So I just think a good, healthy dose of questioning yourself.
Sure. And even, like, the guys you think that don't.
They don't fucking think that, man. Yeah. And I think, like, being honest with that.
But I think the biggest fear, like when you were talking about that feeling on set after a certain amount of time on a series or whatever, and you start comparing yourself to other people, I think the bigger fear is when you're sitting there going, like, now my life is just as boring as any other fucker's. Isn't that...
I don't know, man. I mean,
doesn't work become work after a certain point? I mean, obviously we're not, you know, we're working for ourselves, and there's a lot of creativity to it, but I imagine there is a sort of prison to that too.
I think there can be, and I think that it's up to you. I think it's up to you to raise your stakes if they're
that's
not
right.
being raised.
I think that's true.
You have to raise your stakes.
Yeah, and as a creative person, there's always stakes to be raised. There's always 100%. Something you can do, even if other people don't see it. You know that, like, I did have something a little different there.
And that's it.
So, how did you meet your wife? Where did the family all happen? I mean, three kids, a lot of kids. How old are they?
My daughter's three, and I have a son that's five and a son that's seven.
So it's pretty new.
Yeah.
How long have you been married?
We've been married for 7 years now.
Oh, yeah, so that's pretty new.
Yeah.
Where'd you meet her?
I met her in D.C. the night I got back from Russia. She was an ICU trauma nurse. worked at Georgetown, met her.
Well, that's nice to have in the house. It's trauma great, nurse. You great. Know exactly what's going on, what it's you got to do.
Yeah,
something bad happens.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, she's, you know, man, she's everything to me, man. She's everything to me. It's been a long road with her, and she's been there with me every step of the way. And, you know, what I was telling you before about, you know, getting in trouble kind of that last time.
Yeah.
When I decided.
2009?
2009, July 3rd. You know, when
you're a grown-ass man.
Grown-ass man, dude. And, you know, guys, I was in Venice Beach, and I had my dogs, and these guys having a house party, these sort of like wannabe, I don't know what the fuck they were, but there's a whole group of them. One of them called my dog over. They grabbed my dog. I tried to get my dog back. He tried to kind of take him, and I grabbed my dog. They started following me, and there's, you know, about 10 of them, and one of them pushed me in the back, and I turned and I hit the guy, and he got knocked out standing up and busted his head on the pavement. It was real bad. And then, you know, I just put my back against a tree, and it was a pretty bad fight. And I got taken in, and you know, we really didn't know whether this guy was going to wake up or not. And I was, you know, down there at the Pacific Division, handcuffed to a bench, and, you know, really did not know what was going to go down. And look, man, this was not like, you know, I wasn't 20.
Right.
I wasn't, you know, I was a guy, you know, been a series regular on a few shows. I'd done a bunch of movies, you know.
The press get hold of it?
Out of life. No, I wasn't quite there. You know what I mean?
Right.
It wasn't like that. It was before Walking Dead.
Oh, okay.
And I remember sitting there and literally as clear as day, you know, having this conversation that, you know, if I go this way into this room, and this guy doesn't wake up, you know, it's going to be this side of me. The darkness has got to come to the front, and that's who you're going to be from now on.
Yeah.
Like, that's what life is going to be like in here. But I said, but if you can just get me out, just wake him up, man, get me out of this one. Like, I am fucking done. And I am ready to dedicate my life to the things that I know I need to be dedicating them to. And the first and foremost was her.
Yeah.
And
she was, she had to come down to the station.
The whole thing, man.
And the guy woke up?
He did. And look, that really changed everything. That one event kind of changed everything for me. And
did you make an amends?
Big time. And, you know, I really look at what happened with that guy that night and looking at him, you know, I think there was part of what I was doing that night was hitting, you know, was trying to smash something that had been inside of me for so long.
Uh-huh.
And this loudness, this brazenness, this carelessness, and
impulse control too.
Big time,
right?
Man. Big time.
Because, like, you know, I mean, I guess you got to relive that a little bit in that first episode or second episode of Punisher, you know, with those guys coming up on you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know that.
Well, what's crazy is that, you know, I think in that sense, like in that character and in a lot of the stuff I play, it's like, you know, we're tapping into a lot of this stuff. And it's funny because, you know, 2009 isn't that long ago, but you know, man, I've like found, I'm a extremely peaceful man now. You know, I love fatherhood.
Yeah.
I've never been humbled by anything. Like, I've been humbled by this.
Don't want to fuck that up.
Don't want to fuck this up, man. And I'm absolutely in love with my wife. And you know, like I found this thing now where I can really, I still have the fire, but I can really channel it now.
Clearly, but I think it's interesting how you phrase that, because I don't think I've heard it phrased like that before. That despite your whatever your intentions were, because of choices you've made, the darkness will have to come to the front just to survive.
That's it, and it was clear as day. And it wasn't one of these things like, okay, buddy, you better steel yourself.
Yeah,
like this, you know, it was in that room being handcuffed to that. I know enough about what's on the other side of that wall.
Yeah.
That if this goes down this way, it's all over. That life. One way or the other, life as I knew it before was over, and it was time to. It's not like, hey, man, I gotta muster up the change. It's over. It's over one way or the other. We're going one way or the other here. And what a blessing to be presented with that in such a clear and concise way. We're sticking to it. You know, it's not about like, hey, let's fight through this thing. It's like, hey, look, man, it's one way or the other. And it was as clear as anything that I've ever looked at.
Right.
And it's so it
really is black or white, because you know that, like, you know, you've you went too far, and now you got to, you know, survive in that the chaos of just monsters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that didn't happen.
Me too, man.
And yet now you can just do it on screen.
Yeah, man.
Good talking to you.
You too, brother.
All right, that was John Bernthal. Again, The Punisher's third season is on now. It's available at Netflix, on Netflix, at Netflix, in Netflix. You can stream all of the episodes, all of the seasons right now. I got my wah-wah pedal hooked up with the Echoplex into the old amp. Kind of analog. Echoplex is it's a reissue of the old sound done without the big tape loops. Dig it. Boomer lives.